All right, well, welcome everyone. My name is Robert Smith. I'm the Vice President for Speakers of the St. Thomas More Society. And on behalf of the Society, we'd like to thank the Thomistic Institute, an academic institute through the Pontifical Faculty of the Immaculate Conception at the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C. And we are very happy today to have a wonderful speaker with us to be talking about international human rights and Catholic social teaching. Paolo Carozza is the director of the Kellogg Institute for International Studies, an interdisciplinary, university-wide institute focusing primarily on the themes of democracy and human development at the Notre Dame Law School. From 2006 to 2010, Carozza was a member of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, the principal international body responsible for the promotion and protection of human rights in the Western Hemisphere, and served as its president in 2008 and 2009. He has also served the Holy See in various capacities and was appointed by Pope Francis in 2016 to be member of the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences. He received both his bachelor's degree and his law degree from Harvard. So, if you'll join me in welcoming Paolo Carozza.
Terrific, thank you. Thanks for having me. Thanks to the Thomistic Institute. It's been a long time since I had my last occasion to visit UVA Law School, and so it's great to be back. It's a wonderful place, and I love it here. I'm going to try to talk for about 45 minutes. I'll aim for that, so that we have time for discussion and questions afterwards as well. So human rights and the Catholic social tradition. For reasons you'll see, I've used the word tradition rather than teaching, because we're going a little bit beyond just the formal, magisterial teaching of the church, although that will probably be the main focus of what I'll talk about. But let's start with with this guy, because who can deny the fascination that Pope Francis has had for us, for a lot of the world since the start of his papacy, whether people are Catholic or not, whether they're in agreement or not with his critique of the global economic system, or with his penchant for opening the doors to new debates on very sensitive moral and cultural questions, so many people are attracted to him for this, for his sincere, simple, deep, and direct commitment to the poor and to the oppressed, which is undeniable. We're moved by his call to solidarity with the outcast and marginalized, by his personal witness of solidarity with them. This was him speaking at the UN. I was there the week after he was to give a talk. And, I'm used to being like the only Catholic in a room of, secular scholars and people of other faiths around the world. And so I don't usually cite the Pope in my talks, you know. And so I go to the UN and I'm at this panel and I'm like the only Catholic there and the only person who is not citing Pope Francis. And I thought, wow, the world is a strange place. You know, everything's just turned upside down here. So, but at the same time, I mean, precisely because of how much he talks about questions of global justice and the cry of the poor, for someone like me who's spent 30 years thinking about and writing about and teaching about these issues through the lens of human rights, one of the most striking things is how little Francis talks about human rights. And, you know, this is in a world where we inescapably associate the demands of justice with the concept of human rights, the practice of human rights, especially at a global level, right? It's true across cultures, across political systems, across ethical frameworks. Claims of human rights dominate the discourse that we're engaged in. And that's largely been true within the Catholic Church, too, right? For at least 75 years, popes have consistently affirmed, even championed, the idea of human rights and used it as the ground on which to engage in a global debate. So what's going on? What's going on with Francis? So in order to understand what's happening today, we need a little bit of history, a historical reconstruction, if you will, of this long and complicated thread of Catholic understandings of and relationship to human rights. So don't tell my historian colleagues, but I'm going to try to do like 2,000 years of history in the next 15 minutes. But what I'm going to try to show, big picture, is this. First of all, there is, in fact, a long tradition of human rights in the teaching of the Catholic Church. Second, though, at the same time, the underlying content and structure of that Catholic tradition of human rights is very different from much of what is offered in the common language and practice of human rights in the world today. And so when we get to the last chapter of the story, Francis, we'll see in the end that he actually has a great deal of continuity with this Catholic understanding of human rights, one that helps us understand why and how he does invoke human rights as an idea, but also why he critiques it, sometimes severely, and also, finally, why he sometimes shies away from using it at all in favor of a language that's more oriented towards responsibilities and solidarity rather than rights. Okay? Now, one caveat before I dive into this further. I'm talking about the teaching and tradition, the ideals of the church. I'm not talking about the practice of the church historically, which in a variety of ways and through a variety of periods of history has been quite responsible for many violations of human rights. So I'm not trying to whitewash that or set that aside, and we can talk about that if you want to later. But what we're trying to do is reconstruct the teaching and the ideal here that it strives for, however unfaithful the humans who are, you know, where the divine of the church passes through are to that ideal in any given time. Okay, so let's go back to the beginning. In a certain sense, you could say that the church has always been preoccupied throughout its entire history with the foundations and content of what we call today human rights, even if it hasn't used that term as such. Okay, so, you know, here we go, the beginning. The cornerstone of the idea of human rights today, 21st century, is the affirmation of the basic moral equality of all men and women, right? An idea that is indebted to Christian understandings of the fundamental dignity of human beings created in the image of God, hence Michelangelo here and the Sistine Chapel. From the beginning, the church taught the duty to relieve poverty in ways that are strikingly consonant with modern ideas of human rights that require the satisfaction of people's basic material needs. Early on, we find church fathers already preaching on the importance of religious freedom. You know, you can consider Pope Nicholas I in the 9th century condemns torture for the first time and opposes trials by ordeal. So, you know, we lawyers like that, right? Due process, that's where it begins. There are any number of other examples where the sources, you can see that the sources of what we think of as human rights today are present right from the springs of Christian civilization from the start, from the earliest days of the church. But it's also true that in none of those examples are we actually using the language and the concept of human rights as such. Okay? And this does matter, because the concept of universal subjective, in the sense of belonging to the individual person, natural rights as individual claims, is different from simply saying, this is the right thing to do. Subjective rights versus the right. Okay? And it was only a contribution of a later historical intellectual age to develop that conceptual framework, which makes the term human rights even comprehensible to us, right, in the terms that we think about it today. So a great historian named Brian Tierney has shown that the idea of natural rights was the fruit of a Christian jurisprudence and philosophy in the late Middle Ages. So that's where we have to turn next, and in particular to this person, all right? A second Francis, if you will, right? This is going to be, in some senses, a story of three Francises. And here's the second one. So Tierney and other scholars point in particular to Franciscan thought, starting in the 12th century and onwards, as being, you know, really the origin of the modern idea of natural rights. Franciscan, you know, movement was sort of the cradle of it, as you will. Tierney puts it this way. He says, if we go back to the early days of the order, the whole Franciscan movement can be seen as a culmination in the religious sphere of the personalism and individualism that also influenced 12th century law. From the beginning, there was a special kind of individualism in Francis's attitude to the world around them. He did not love mankind in the abstract, but particular men and women. It's a great observation. Okay? So, for example, here's Francis giving his rule to, presenting his rule to the Pope. And he lays down in his rule that all of his brothers were to obey their superiors. But then, which is common to religious rules of the time, but then he adds, quote, in everything that's not against their conscience. I mean, you know, so that opens up a huge sort of debate, if nothing else, right? And then a little bit later in 1250, starting in 1215 onward, these intense internal church conflicts going on involving the Franciscans and property rights, okay, that you know, evolves into a very legalistic concern with individual rights in the writings of the various Franciscan masters of the time. That then, you know, by the 14th century, that comes to a bitter dispute over property rights. This is still Francis, not the 14th century, but you can see it already originated in him. Right here, he's giving away all of his clothing in the famous episode where he, you know, he strips himself to show that everything that he had been given from his father doesn't belong to him anymore. And those debates over property rights, right, became the ground on which a lot of the thinking about natural rights developed. Again, to use Tierney's words, he says, no participant in the Franciscan property controversy set out deliberately to compose a treatise on natural rights. But in the course of the arguments that arose, all kinds of such rights came under discussion. The right to acquire property, rights to establish governments, rights to limit their powers, natural rights as distinguished from civil rights, alienable natural rights and inalienable natural rights, natural rights that were duties from those that were not, and so on, right? So all this lays the groundwork for what emerges later as the idea of human rights in a coherent way, okay? So this gradual accretion of thoughts going on in history, in the philosophical and juridical foundations being laid. And then there comes a moment where, for the first time, we can say, okay, this is the time and place where, in the first recognizable way, the idea of human rights becomes explicit and named as such, right? And that is in Salamanca, Spain, in the 16th century. This is the library at the University of Salamanca, much as it would have been then, when the Dominican friar, Francisco de Vitoria, so now we have our third Francis in play, right? It sounds like a bad joke, okay? A Dominican, a Franciscan, a Jesuit, all named Francis, go into a bar, but I'm not going to finish that. You can try on your own. So Francisco de Vitoria and his fellow scholars in what was called the School of Salamanca at the time made it their a point to renew the study of natural law. And they tried to make those studies applicable to the most pressing moral dilemma of their time, which was, what were the implications of the Christian conquest and colonization of the New World? Okay, so they were asking questions like, what were the rights of native populations to their land? What was the basis of their political sovereignty? So Vittoria and his followers, they vigorously and systematically defend the rights of the indigenous people to full ownership of their lands, to equality, to sovereignty, even to religious freedom. And especially they do so on the basis that their natural rights were grounded in their creation as rational beings in God's image, right? Vittoria's fellow Dominican, a guy named Bartolomé de las Casas, one of my great heroes, here depicted in a painting, was given the title by the Spanish crown of Defender of the Indians. And he became Bishop of Chiapas in what is now Mexico. And he was, you know, pleading tirelessly on behalf of the indigenous people throughout his life, had these famous debates in Spain in 1550 over whether the native populations could be deprived of their rights or not. And there's a lot that could be said, but there are two important points, really, about this period in history. One is that Las Casas founds this idea of rights in the principle that that we're all common members of a human family. Okay. Secondly, he frames the claims of justice in terms of rights. Right. The rights of indigenous people. He uses the term right not merely in reference to what is right, the objective law, but what rights do they have? Right. A claim, the same way we would understand a claim of human rights today. And these two things together make this really sort of the first clear example of Catholic human rights discourse historically, okay? And remember, this is the middle of the 16th century. So Catholic approaches to human rights, or you could say natural rights, were Catholic and Christian before they were modern. Because it's only, you know, a century later when Thomas Hobbes comes along, 1660. This is from the original print of his book. You might not be able to see it from that distance, right? But, you know, this is the sovereign, and if you look at the chainmail that the sovereign is wearing, it's composed of all people. It's all the people of the of a polis, right? And the sovereign unites them and has his sovereignty. And so his, you know, Hobbes' Leviathan. So a century later, Hobbes probably knows about the school of Salamanca and the writings there and their efforts to construct a theory of natural rights, because their theory of natural rights, Vitoria's, made the sovereign limited and accountable, things that Hobbes didn't want, right? So in reaction, what does he do in his book, Leviathan? First of all, he engages in this extraordinarily vicious attack on the Catholic Church and everything about Catholicism. That's the part of Leviathan that's usually not read, right, and assigned in courses. But the whole last part, starting from the Eucharist to the Pope, I mean, it's just like, wow. But he couples that, critically for human rights, with this theory of human nature, okay, that is very different from the one that was being worked with and proposed by Vittoria and his followers a century earlier. Instead of understanding people as naturally social and as bearing dignity by virtue of being created in the likeness of God, Hobbes offers this understanding of people as naturally solitary and antagonistic and selfish, right? Now, other fathers of the Enlightenment natural rights theories weren't always as extreme in their characterizations of human nature as Hobbes was. But relative to the classical natural law tradition, they all shared this common sort of reduction of the ends of human life and of politics. So for all of them, you know, rights emerge primarily from individuals' instincts for self-preservation, their need for physical security, and their self regarding nature. So right at its core, you can see that the modern Enlightenment idea of human rights that starts to emerge here begins from a fundamentally different set of assumptions about human persons and the destiny of human life than the idea of human rights that was articulated already a century earlier in the natural law tradition. And so the conflict that, you know, emerges between these two traditions comes to the fore, of course, in the French Revolution. Right? Here's an example, one copy of the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen. And especially in this period, in the 19th century, from the late 18th century through the 19th century, and especially in the papal responses to what the French Revolution, right, that we get a lot of our, what I regard as our contemporary misunderstandings of Catholic teaching on human rights and where they originate, right? Because, you know, it's absolutely true that for over a century in this period, what's going on? The popes are vehemently opposed to what they see as the errors and excesses of the French Revolution. And of 19th century liberalism more generally. So like, you know, Pius VI, for example, he issues a papacy's direct condemnation of this document, of the French Declaration. And, you know, refers to its 17 articles as, quote, those rights so averse to religion and society. And then his successors continued these attacks. And, you know, Pius IX had issued the famous Syllabus of Errors, right? 1864, and that lists liberalism's separation of church and state and freedom of religion as among the positions that are absolutely condemned by the church at the time. Okay. Now, you know, from the 21st century, it's relatively easy in hindsight for us to say, oh, yeah, the 19th century popes, they just got it wrong. Right, they misunderstood the nature of political liberties that were being asserted, especially with respect to religious liberty. And we see that much later after the Second Vatican Council. But we have to see this condemnation in, you know, an intellectual and historical context, right? Where they become a little bit more intelligible, at least, and not just anachronistic. So politically, what was going on? The popes are responding to what they understood to be a comprehensive attack on the place of religion and the Catholic Church in society, right? Here's a painting from the era. Obviously, there were no photographs yet at the time, that shows the destruction and looting of one of the Catholic churches, routine events in the time. Quite intense and violent persecution of the church, and particularly of the clergy. So they're perceiving this assertion of the rights of man to be wedded to this profoundly anti-Catholic ideology and practice. So intellectually, their condemnations were based on a broad critique of the anthropological foundations of rights that emerged in the Enlightenment. The primary target of their criticism was this view of human nature as being fundamentally autonomous, naturally free in an absolute sense that denies humans structural dependence on God or their naturally social natures with one another. That's what Pope Pius IX is referring to when he refers to the monstrous right of absolute liberty as being asserted at the time. Okay, it has no regard to truth, he says, and so it would lead to excessive individualism, to the privatization and suppression of religion, and ultimately to the absolutism of the state, which would be subject to no higher authority. Now, if you think about all those three things, 19th century, it's almost prescient of what we see in the 20th century, really, right? So far from being anachronistic, it was actually very forward-looking in a certain sense. So to just sort of summarize that, the real object of the Church's concern in its teaching on human rights in the 19th century wasn't so much the idea that human rights as such are mistaken or as wrong, but rather the political and ideological uses of rights to attack religion and the foundations of rights in this very reductive kind of secularized rationalism. Those are the things that distort human freedom in the teaching of the Church at the time. Okay? Now, of course, it is also true, I'm not going to deny it, that in opposition to these threats, the popes of the time didn't make any effort to offer a more affirmative vision of rights, a positive version or alternative to the one that they were condemning, okay? The one that might be more expressive to and authentic to the Catholic principles that preceded it. So that had to wait until this guy came along, Pope Leo XIII, at the end of the 19th century, okay? Starting in 1878, very long pontificate, and he retrieves this older Catholic vision of human rights for the Church as a whole. He reproposes it, if you would, but for the modern world now. So, like the popes before him, Leo XIII still teaches that the notion of rights separated from the authority of God would be likely to confuse truth and falsehood and would ultimately place natural rights at the mercy of the changing whims of human legislators. Okay? But unlike his predecessors, along with that critique, he develops this extraordinary body of teaching to propose a different understanding. One that's grounded in the divine and truer to a different understanding of human nature. So on the basis of the older natural law tradition, he affirms, for example, in particular, the right to marriage, the right to education, the right of individuals to join together to form private societies, especially association of workers, given the modern economy, the right to private property, the right of procuring the things which sustain life. It's a great phrase that later gets reformulated in Catholic social thinking as a right to work and the right to a living wage. Okay? But just as significant as the list of rights, he develops in his writings that, you know, ideas that these rights belong to individuals in as much as the person, you could say, ontologically precedes the state. Okay? It's not dependent on the state for these things. And he deals with the relationship of rights to the common good, rights to duties, both of which permit him to address questions like the hierarchy of rights and what to do when rights conflict. Okay? So there's undoubtedly very good reason to see, as a lot of people do, that in Leo XIII, and especially the great encyclical Rerum Novarum, which is marked as sort of the beginning contemporary of modern Catholic social teaching, a turning point in the relationship of the Church to the idea of human rights. Okay. He offers this, you know, kind of robust alternative, you could say, to secular rights theories, and does so, you know, in a way that allows us then to engage the modern world at that time. So the timing was nothing short of providential, because, you know, it helps light a way for the Church to begin to face the darknesses of the 20th century, you could say, right? So Pius XI, for example, relies heavily on those teachings in his encyclicals that address and condemn the totalitarian dictatorships that are emerging and the threats of modern economic models that they posed for basic human dignity. And then he in turn paves the way for Pius XII right here, who did, you know, maybe more than any other pope, quite underappreciated, in helping to globalize the discourse of human dignity and human rights in the mid-20th century. Right in the middle of the Second World War, he's the one who calls for a recognition of a list of basic rights, including the right to life, to religious freedom, to family life, to work, the right to choose a vocation, the right to make proper use of material goods, as he put it. And here he is giving his famous 1942 Christmas radio address. He says, all of these flow from the dignity of the human person, created in the image of God, called to participate in his eternal life. So by 1948, when this, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, gets drafted and adopted, here it's being held by Eleanor Roosevelt, who played a key role in its formulation and adoption. Another one of my heroes, she's awesome. By that time, Catholic pronouncements on human dignity and the dignity of the human person were absolutely pervasive in political discourse, so well developed that they in fact exerted a significant influence, indirect but very clear, historically documented not only by Catholic scholars, the influence over the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and a lot of the language of human rights and human dignity that makes its way into the new constitutions that are being adopted and drafted in the wake of World War II. So against that background, you know, it's not so surprising that that by 1963, John the 23rd, here he's reading his encyclical Pacem in Terris. In that encyclical, St. John the 23rd praises the Universal Declaration as an act of the highest importance, right? This secular document of rights. He devotes a significant portion of this encyclical to an enumeration and discussion of the inviolable rights of all human beings. But once again, we have to see, for John the 23rd, the tradition of natural rights was unquestionably different in its foundations, and therefore also in some of its ends, from certain other ways of understanding human rights. The starting point's in natural law, in the creation God. And so he affirms among the universal and inviolable rights, life, property, association, education, all rights recognizable in classical liberal theory, but then adds to them things like the right to follow one's conscience in honoring God, the right to work suited to one's capacities, this notion of vocation, right? The right to form and belong to intermediate groups in society. John concludes this discussion of human rights by articulating what he regards as the true and ultimate aim of human rights. And here I'll show you this quotation, even though I'm not going to read the whole thing in the interest of time. But he says, among other things, he says, when society is formed on the basis of rights and duties, men attain to a better knowledge of the true God, a personal God transcending human nature. They recognize that their relationship with God forms the very foundation of their life. So in other words, in his view, a true understanding of the basis of human rights aims us towards communion with others and ultimately towards our destiny in beatitude with God. It's a radically different understanding from prevailing secular rights theories, right? Which precisely in this period in particular, 1963 and its immediate aftermath, you know, begin to turn more and more towards an emphasis on individualism, relativism, statism, personal autonomy as the sort of lodestones of what rights are about. The Second Vatican Council, 3 years later, this is one of the photos of it, isn't this awesome? All of the bishops in council in St. Peter's Church, affirms the same ideas, right? The exalted dignity, property, human person, the basis of rights and duties in that, and concludes that therefore there must be made available to all men everything necessary for leading a life truly human, food, clothing, shelter, the right to choose a state of life freely, to found a family, the right to education, to employment, to a good reputation, to respect, to appropriate information, to activity in accord with the upright norm of one's own conscience. How's that for such a Catholic human right? Huh? Okay. The protection of privacy, rightful freedom, even in matters religious. I mean, it's a very comprehensive view of the content of human rights, right in the council documents. And maybe most significant of all is that one of the documents that was adopted is, of course, Dignitatis Humanae, the Declaration on Religious Freedom, one of the most central and important expressions of human dignity and rights that flow from it in all of the 2,000 years of Catholic tradition. Paul VI continues that same line. He just extends it really to the problem of global development and poverty in particular in his 1968 encyclical, Populorum Progressio. And then comes, the person who did more than anyone else ever, including Leo XIII, to make human rights absolutely central to Catholic social teaching, and that's this man, St. John Paul II. John Paul II, stresses the existence and universality of fundamental rights in a completely unprecedented way at that point, right? He gives it this breadth and centrality to his teaching and to Catholic social teaching in general, right from his very first encyclical, Redemptor Hominis, where he says he hopes that, quote, human rights will become throughout the world a fundamental principle of work for man's welfare. Here he is also at the United Nations General Assembly on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the UN in 1985. And he says, there are indeed universal human rights rooted in the nature of the person, rights which reflect the objective and inviolable demands of a universal moral law. For this reason, then, he describes the Universal Declaration as one of the highest expressions of the human conscience of our time. Again, continuing this really strong endorsement of secular human rights sort of project, if you will. Okay, but at the same time, right, the thread that we started seeing already in the late Middle Ages continues, because John Paul's reflections on human rights preserved and even heightened this tension that I've been tracing, right? He was also severely critical of certain claims of rights that are grounded in radically different understandings of human nature. So, you know, his identification of this sort of contradiction in the ideal of human rights and in contemporary ideologies of human rights is, I don't have time to quote it at length, but here's just some of it. He says, you know, on the one hand, there's this growing moral sensitivity alert to acknowledging the value and dignity of every individual as a human being, and that's a good thing. He's endorsing that very strongly, making it central to Catholic thought. But then he says in the same document, you know, next paragraph, on the other hand, right, taking just a few of these, how can we reconcile these declarations with the refusal to accept those who are weak and needy, elderly, those who have just been conceived, right? It wasn't Francis wasn't the first one to put the marginalized and the weak and the needy at the center of a Catholic idea of justice. John Paul II says, rather than societies of people living together, our societies risk becoming societies of people who are rejected, marginalized, uprooted, and oppressed. Sounds exactly like Francis, doesn't it? Okay. So, Pope Benedict, not surprisingly, continues that same line of discourse. In the interest of time, I won't dwell on it, but a couple points that are particularly interesting about Benedict and human rights are these. One is, he gives very clear and explicit credit for the development of human rights to the Enlightenment. And in a positive sense, you know, he refers to human rights and religious freedom as one of the, quote, true conquests of the Enlightenment. This is very contrary to a lot of the stereotypical, views that you might get in the secular press in particular about Pope Benedict. Very appreciative of that. But at the same time, you know, he does still sort of balance that. He says, he also couples that with his criticism of an attempt to ground those same principles on positivist and skeptical foundations. He argues instead for this, you know, as he did throughout everything, of the synergy of faith and reason being the best grounds for tolerance, human rights, and religious freedom. Okay, so let me give a quick recap where we are by this time. Is there a Catholic tradition of human rights? Yes, absolutely. Right, there's a long and distinctive tradition of Catholic thinking about human rights, embracing them as true expressions of the demands of justice, of dignity, the common good, older even than secular liberal Enlightenment traditions of those same ideas. And in many ways, those two different, you know, dialects of rights, if you will, overlap with one another. They result in important common affirmations, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. A lot of the catalog of human rights is recognized in common. And we can even say, along with Pope Benedict, very, very sincerely, that the Catholic tradition learned from and developed in large part in this sort of dialectical relationship with the liberal, secular, and Enlightenment tradition too, in many important constructive and positive ways. But at the same time, we've seen throughout centuries now that some important differences between the traditions persist, right? So where there's a secular emphasis on individualism and relativism and conflict, the Catholic tradition of human rights emphasizes community, solidarity, and the common good. where the Catholic tradition will emphasize the relationship of responsibilities and duties to rights and their complementarity. You can't just talk about rights without talking about responsibilities as well. A Catholic tradition of human rights is grounded ultimately in the relationship of the human person to God, and is oriented towards what it regards as our authentic human natures. And for that reason, rights will eventually be completely relative and subject to changing fashions and powers of the age in an arbitrary way if they're severed from that. The Catholic tradition sort of has consistently affirmed that. That's one of the reasons why religious freedom has emerged with such centrality as the cornerstone of the thinking of about human rights in the Catholic Church. And lastly, for the same reasons, it's a tradition that is consistently oriented in particular towards the most weak and vulnerable of our societies, the poor, the unborn, the sick, the elderly, the displaced. Okay? So, you know, both a use of and praise of the idea of human rights and also a critique, sometimes severe, of human rights go side by side in this tradition. And so finally, now, with that understanding, we can close by returning to a closer look at what's going on with Pope Francis, right? That initial puzzle that I posed about why he doesn't talk about human rights as much as you would think he does, okay? I love this picture from his trip to Africa. Here we have, as beautifully, this image beautifully kind of represents, a pope has this passion for justice, intense solidarity with the poor and the oppressed, and a persistent call to take the church to what he calls the peripheries of human existence, okay? He shows this great continuity with the Catholic tradition of rights and also with a critique of the uses of rights in some cases, right? So on the first side of that equation, he does affirm unequivocally the existence and importance of fundamental human rights, as you see here, right? Again, a snippet of a longer quote. The dignity of person means recognizing that he or she possesses inalienable rights, okay? He goes on to... I don't have time. It's a longer, great quote of his, but I'll have to skip it. He goes on in that affirmation to give special pride of place to religious freedom within it, right? And a special concern for that. Religious freedom, the fundamental right of the human person, and consequently, he insists, national and international laws and organizations must recognize, guarantee, and protect religious liberty. It's an indicator of a healthy democracy and one of the principal sources of a nation's legitimacy, is what he said right here before the United States Congress. And Francis has also echoed John Paul's and Benedict's central concern for the most vulnerable members of the community and their rights. As he puts it in Evangelii Gaudium, he says, among the vulnerable for whom the church wishes to care with particular love and concern are unborn children, the most defenseless and innocent among us. Okay? Nowadays, efforts are made to deny them their human dignity and do with them whatever one pleases, taking their lives and passing laws preventing anyone from standing in the way of this. And then comes this part of the quote. This defense of unborn life is closely linked to the defense of each and every other human rights. Elsewhere, he also, I don't have a quote, but he also very strongly uses the language of the right to life as the foundation for all human rights in relationship to his opposition to the death penalty. Okay. So, Francis's recognition that modern society, notwithstanding its shared commitment to rights, and sometimes even in the name of rights, very frequently turns its back on the weakest and most vulnerable members among us. It also leads him more generally to a critique of certain of the uses of rights language, a critique that is, in fact, even stronger than those of John Paul II and Benedict XVI before him. He says that, you know, sometimes they fail to lead us to greater love for our brothers and sisters. He says, you know, nowadays there's much talk of rights, but frequently neglecting duties. While we speak of new rights, always more rights, always greater scope of rights, the hungry remain at the street corner and ask to be recognized as citizens and receive a healthy diet. We ask for dignity. So from there, Francis, you know, takes this special concern for the poor and the oppressed, and actually uses it as the basis for a critique of certain ways of asserting rights that that in practice hinder our capacity and our desire to help in solidarity those who most need it and who are most vulnerable. So he says, in other words, that you know the answer to this need that we see around us, the hungry at the street corner, the answer isn't just more rights. Right? More rights doesn't necessarily mean more justice. Rather, he critiques it in a much more radical way. He says that rights themselves, in some ways, paradoxically, can be obstacles to a culture of radical solidarity with the poor. Right? Because some ways of understanding and identifying rights can alienate us from one another, separate us from one another, by making selfish assertions not as part of a common good and a common society, but in a very individualistic way, and ways that then sort of anesthetize us to the cry of the poor. So, you know, as he says, sadly, even human rights can be used as a justification for an inordinate defense of individual rights or the rights of the richer peoples at the expense of the poor. That's the quote I just referred to. But here, in a longer passage, he says he broadens that. And he says, look, today there's a tendency to claim ever broader individual rights. I'm tempted to say individualistic, okay? Where, as a result, the rights of the individual are upheld without regard to the fact that each human being's part of a social context, wherein his or her rights and duties are bound up with those of others and with the common good of society itself. He says, further, I believe that it's vital to develop a culture of human rights which links the individual to the common good, the all of us. Unless the rights of each individual are harmoniously ordered to the common good, those rights will end up being considered limitless and consequently will become a source of conflicts and violence. Okay? So in passages like this, you can see that you know Francis' critique is pretty firmly situated in continuity with the critique of certain ways of understanding human rights historically as well. Now, what else does he do? I'm almost done here, but it's worth taking one step more before we close. Because in doing so, Francis is in full continuity with the critique and the embrace of rights, characteristic of Catholic tradition. But he also does take it a little step further. You know, just like John Paul and Benedict did, and John the 23rd did, and Leo did, and Pius the 12th, and all before him. At least two ways that I think are particularly interesting. So first, he tells us. Let's see if I have. This. I just have a few pictures. I don't have quotes for this. These pictures, by the way, are all from work that our institute does in Africa, and they're all sort of beautiful examples, I think, of what Francis is trying to communicate. So the first thing he does in his writing and speaking about these questions of rights and solidarity is he really emphasizes that we have to view the meaning of rights from the perspective of the poor. Right? That's the most sort of authentic and deepest way to give them content. But understanding that poverty in this sense isn't just a question of to be understood in sociological and material terms, right? But as you know, as the locus of the marginalized, the oppressed, the vulnerable, and the weak more generally, that's the perspective we have to adopt in order to understand what rights are supposed to serve, and that's what he means when he's talking about going to the peripheries of human existence and judging from there how to be in the world. So, you know, that place is a privileged location of solidarity for Francis because it's the place where we most authentically encounter the suffering Christ. And it's only from that that we can judge the appropriate meaning and scope of what human rights should be. And second, related to the first point, he insists that we have to guard against a culture in which rights get in the way of unity and get in the way of real communion with one another, right? Guard against those ways of asserting rights or using rights that are forms of alienation in the end and separation and conflict among persons and among peoples. So to put both of these points together, you could say that according to Francis, a commitment to authentic human rights has to be one that leads us to greater solidarity right? Instead of one that fosters separation and alienation among all of the members of the human family. So that, once you see that that's where he's taking this thread, it helps explain also why, in the end, one of the most interesting things is how little he uses the language of human rights, even when he's talking about really fundamental questions of justice, which he cares about so much. It's not the general endorsement or his stinging critique that's most noticeable, but, you know, even an encyclical like Laudato Si, this celebrated, long, sprawling, kind of undisciplined document that talks about so much, so many of sort of, you know, fundamental concerns about human flourishing, says almost nothing about human rights in it. Doesn't use rights language, right? He does in the encyclical refer to the right to water. Here's some boys getting their water in this community. But interestingly, his answer to the collective problem of environmental degradation is not to recognize and affirm and promote everybody's right to a healthy environment, right? But instead to call for greater unity, to call for greater solidarity, collective action towards addressing the underlying problems that plague our common home, as he puts it, okay? So in that UN address that I showed a picture of at the very beginning, in contrast to the speeches that both Benedict and John Paul gave before the General Assembly, theirs were full of the affirmation and talk about human rights, human rights, human rights. It was all about human rights. Francis there barely mentions human rights in his talk at the UN, right? Instead, it's all about social exclusion, inequality, extreme poverty, and the ethical and spiritual foundations of integral human development. The same when he came here and gives his speech to the US Congress, right? It's all an emphasis on the common good, not on the tradition of rights as such. Even in areas where, you know, undeniably individual human rights are at the forefront of our concern, like in the area of migration and refugees and refugee flows today, Francis has generally avoided framing those issues in terms of, explicitly at least, in terms of the human rights of migrants, right? Instead, he takes this more community-centered approach. He ties the acceptance of migrants to the common good of building a successful nation. And in doing so, makes this powerful but not human rights-centered argument in favor of a more tolerant and open immigration policy, right? With respect to the crisis of Syrian refugees, for example, he says, he doesn't appeal to human rights, but he says things like this: our world is facing a refugee crisis of a magnitude not seen since the Second World War. This presents us with great challenges and many hard decisions. Okay, fair enough. Then he says, we must not be taken aback by their numbers, but rather view them as persons, seeing their faces, listening to their stories, trying to respond as best we can to their situation, to respond in a way which is always humane, just, and fraternal, right? It's all about relationships, about seeing the authenticity of the human being and human dignity in relationships. And rights don't always help us do that, he says, right? And implies, at least. So so let me close with just one last thought. What does this mean for us today? Right, beyond understanding what Pope Francis is trying to do, but with respect to our interest in and engagement concretely in human rights as lawyers, citizens, and people in the world. I think there are two things that might be said more, but I'll limit myself to two about it. First, the idea of accompaniment. We have to take seriously the path that Francis is pointing us when he says that there are misuses of human rights, okay? That if human rights aren't lived as a form of radical solidarity and accompaniment of the poor, we'll allow them to become excessively individualistic kinds of claims that will entrench alienation, disunity, instead of helping us to construct a common good, okay? And that misuse will corrupt our societies rather than strengthen and redeem them, okay? A culture of dignity and solidarity for Francis is greater than, and itself is what gives meaning to human rights and directs them in the right way. So to put it a different way, he says, human rights are important, human rights have their place, but their place is limited, right? And instead, what he calls social love, which he talks about in his encyclical even more than social justice, okay, transcends that limited discourse of human rights and is and has to be seen as the framework which gives them meaning and gives them direction, okay, not the other way around. And second, and lastly, by stressing that human rights are subordinate to this larger need for integral human development, Francis, in continuity with the tradition before him, clearly regards the challenge of respecting and protecting human dignity as being more than just a technical, political, or legal problem. Okay? Our temptation, especially those of us who are lawyers, law students, like probably most of you are, and myself, is to rely on technique, right? On that technique that we've learned, the institutions and the rules and the processes of law to do it. And that's all great, but he's suggesting to us that that has to be part of a broader vision about the meaning and destiny of human life itself, right? To have it in the right service. So this is one thing that he did say in that speech to the UN. He says, integral human development and the full exercise of human dignity cannot be imposed. They must be built up and allowed to unfold for each individual, for every family, in communion with others and in a right relationship with all those areas in which human social life develops. In other words, what he's saying is that the fulfillment of this vision of human rights has to be grounded, above all, in a question of education. But education in the broadest sense, an education about the meaning of life and the destiny of life and the purpose of human beings and human communities. That, legal norms and institutions by themselves can't substitute for that, can't substitute for the education of our capacity to embrace the whole mystery of human life, of each and every human person, and a recognition of what human hearts yearn for. So that's where, you know, the mission, that the point about human rights becomes part of the mission of universities, of this university, of mine, and all of us who are involved in the educational project, okay? So I went 5 minutes longer than I intended to. I'm sorry I had to speak really fast in order to do that too, but that does leave us time for questions and discussions. The talk, I know, was historical and kind of abstract and theoretical, and I'm also really happy to talk about very practical aspects. I've done a lot of practical work in human rights, too, if you have questions about that or how that translates into it. But whatever you want to talk about is great.
Well, first, let's thank you.
Statement of human rights and also, I guess, like a floor or benchmark sometimes in international relations or even sometimes like domestic policy. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of policies that have been created that have been informed very concretely by something like the encyclicals you talked about, very concretely by Catholic social teaching on these issues, and how should we be thinking about bringing that into the public square, not just like a personal conversion, a personal interest, policy interests as well?
Yeah. So we do need to translate these things into the techniques of law, right? I'm not suggesting it's not, just that that's not enough. And the Catholic development of the ideas was, sorry, it would be on this picture because it's distracting me, contributed a lot to the formulation of statements, you know, bills of rights and their equivalent in a lot of democratic constitutional systems and in the contemporary world, not just in the immediate post-war period, but after what, you know, political scientists and scholars of democracy refer to as the third wave of democratization that happened mostly in the 1980s. You know, again, it's not accidental that that the majority of those countries that were able to make a transition to democracy were Catholic ones, and that the Church contributed very significantly to the establishment of, you know, democracy and the constitutional rule of law and the protection of rights. So so it's influenced the practice in all sorts of ways. But you're probably looking for something even more specific than that.
If you have something, or I'm just thinking of you know, maybe, I don't want to call it a disconnect, but kind of the clear statements that come from the Vatican and then the clear statement that comes from the UN and kind of how the overlap is interesting to look at, but I don't feel like maybe there's as much policy outflow from both of those things, if that makes sense.
Well, gosh, maybe. I guess I would actually be inclined to say that at least with respect to the UN, there's all too much policy outflow in this sense that, you know, the human rights project, the secular human rights project, with all the right intentions and sort of sincerity of aims, right, in trying to achieve justice and promote human dignity, has essentially been focused on taking the Universal Declaration and translating it as much as possible into more and more and more positive laws, right? More treaties, courts, institutions, I mean, that's been the project of 70 years, right? If we can make positive law out of that, then that'll be our salvation. Then societies will be more just, human rights will go away, human rights violations will go away, and so forth. You know, one of the most striking things of anyone in who's sort of active in the human rights world is not how little there is, but how much there is, right? But in particular, how much there is that doesn't actually seem to affect the conditions of people in their societies, in the communities they live in the relationships they have, in their workplaces, in their families, in their political life, right? That's where there's the gap, right? There's a lot of policy, but the policy doesn't actually affect what's going on so often. And that's where I think the church maybe has more to contribute than it has, in fact, succeeded in doing. It's all there, but you kind of have to unearth it and dust it off this time. And because it's you know, it is the way that the church approaches these things, Francis among them, but in a special way, that in some senses is recalling for us part of the reason why just more positivization of human rights isn't enough. To realize human dignity, there needs to be something more that moves people, that unites them, that gets them, you know, gives them reason. You know, I teach, you know, human rights courses to students who come in from all over the world to specialize in human rights. LLM students, doctoral students, every year they come from all over the world, and they're committed to it. They have long experience in it, and they come into my class at the beginning of every fall, and it's the same, you know, 20 years, it's the same. They're really good, sincere, committed, courageous people who put their lives on the line. And the question that they have when they come in is, how do I take human rights and make them more powerful? How do I translate them into more effective structures and systems? It is a great question, but they never ask the question that comes before that, right? They take for granted the question that comes before that, which is, well, where do human rights come from? And why should I be committed to them to begin with? Right? What are they for? And so in part, what the church is doing is reminding us that the torrent of policy and positivization of the law, if it isn't attentive to that foundational question of where these things come from and why should we be committed to them and what are they for and what are they aimed at the end of the day, it's all going to be ineffective. It's not going to change anything.
So would you argue that, like, maximize utility, NGOs should be more focused on those donative, like, aspects of what they're doing and less so on lobbying efforts to promote more policy?
Well, not necessarily, in the sense that, you know, in big and complicated political systems and structures, national and international, you have to have specialized bodies of civil society who focus on particular things and focus on policy and stuff. So we would be bad off in a different way if everybody just abandoned that and said, oh, you know, let's go start reading the foundational documents or just engage in an educational effort and not worry about advocacy and lobbying and litigation, right? So you need those as well. But I would suggest that if you take it as a whole, we have a problem that it's much more skewed just towards the latter, and there's not enough going on of the other of the more foundational.
Yeah,
things.
That's what I was asking. Do you think there should be some sort of redistribution to that end?
I do. I do. And then, in particular, sort of added to the problem is not just that there is a lot of lobbying, litigation, and that kind of work, but that it has become, almost in sort of a classic Weberian style for the sociologists among you, increasingly specialized and fragmented, right? So you get more and more, the human rights advocate who works just on like this tiny little bit of the question of what human dignity might mean. And what we end up with is a discourse of human rights that is more and more distant from the idea that there's a sort of unity to human dignity, that all human rights have to sort of exist together with one another, right? All authentic human rights are part of something greater. And the more that we're taking them, breaking them off into tiny little pieces and becoming just advocates of one or just advocates of another or just advocates of this, the harder it is to actually maintain a coherent vision of the whole and what the whole is for, right? So, it's totally understandable that starting in the 60s, the international human rights sort of movement begins to focus more and more on particular segments of the human family. Right, and in particular ones who have undeniably suffered in distinctive ways systematic violations of human rights, right? So there's the Convention on Racial Discrimination, and there's the Convention on Discrimination Against Women, and then there's one on children, and then, there's one on the rights of the disabled, and you can go on, and there's focuses on indigenous peoples. And it's true that all of those groups, when you look at just sort of the facts, the empirical data, have and continue to suffer in systematic ways from violations of human dignity that are distinctive, right? So it makes sense. But there's a cost to it too, right? The cost is the more that we're fragmenting human rights and saying, okay, I just care about the human rights of women. Oh, I only just care about the human rights of indigenous peoples. We're asking less and less, but what does it mean to be a human being in all of this, right? Human rights are universal, not because rights are universal, but because the human being is universal. So if we stop asking about what is universal about the human being, we lose sight of the universality of rights as a whole. Yeah.
So trying to tie human rights to either the teachings of a particular religion or having it come from the leadership of a particular religion, like how do you see that as potentially being counterproductive to get universal support for certain fundamental ideals about what human rights are in the context of, well, people that don't follow that particular belief system or a different religion or no religion. So trying to tie human rights to something more.
It's a fantastic question, and it's not just a theoretical question. I can guarantee I've struggled with that personally for 30 years. I mean, when I was a member of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and we're making decisions on, human rights cases and policies for 35 countries of the Western Hemisphere, and there are seven of us, and I'm the only one who's a believing Christian in the group in the room. How do you have a discussion that is in any way, constructive of that? I can't go and say, "Oh yeah, but John Paul II said," So it's a real challenge. And I guess I would say this in response to it. One is if we really aspire to a universal recognition of the value of human rights. We have to be prepared to try to ground those human rights not just in one tradition, but in multiple ones. So to the extent that I, as a Catholic, I need to understand my own tradition and ground it in that. But I also need to sort of try hard to understand and see and engage in a dialogue with someone who's coming from the Islamic world, someone who is a secularist who doesn't believe in God, but has a sort of this inherent sort of sense of justice and dignity and the good, that has to be part of the effort that's made, or by definition the project fails before it begins. Okay. But I had two more things too that are really critical. One is you can only do that, I think, if you are adequately rooted in your own tradition first, right? There's no authentic cross-cultural dialogue where nobody belongs to anything. That's just fake, and it's superficial, and nothing happens, right? So among the work that I've done at the Holy See that Robert was referring to but didn't mention explicitly, I've been I was involved for about 3 years in with the Pontifical Council on Interreligious Dialogue on Catholic-Muslim dialogue on a variety of issues. So believe me, I know very much how hard it is. But I know that the only way that you have any chance of having a sincere and genuine dialogue that's going to be fruitful is if each participant in this dialogue is capable of understanding where they stand. And then you can move, and then you can encounter the other, right? If you stand nowhere, then that's not possible. And the second and last thought is this, that Catholic social thought, on the one hand, is it's important to understand that it's not just based on distinctively Christian revelation, right? I mean, there are claims that are informed by and shaped by the human experience. Right, and evolve according to it, and therefore aspire at least to speak to the authenticity of human desires and needs, not just for Catholics, but for anybody. Now, does it succeed in doing that? Is a harder question. Sometimes yes, and sometimes not. Sometimes, you know, like any body of discourse, I know, what's a good analogy? We exist in comfort zones. Right, just like in personal relationships, or at a dinner party, or you know, you're at a social occasion, you have a certain comfort zone of things that you're happy talking about, and other ones that you're not, and so I think while Catholic social thought has this aspiration to a certain kind of universal validity on the basis of human experience, there's no question that we have our comfort zones, and there are ways in which there's a certain kind of discomfort of talking about certain kinds of things within the Catholic tradition that, you know, we've got to overcome, or we've got to face honestly if we do hope to make it something that has more universal appeal or recognition to it. Yeah.
Well, this gets to comfort zones as well as Catholic-Muslim dialogue. And specifically, I was thinking of Pope Francis's comment about the refugee crisis being the biggest one since the Second World War. But the Syrian refugee crisis seems to present issues that weren't maybe present in the refugee crisis in order to, specifically the threat of violent Islamic terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking about, specifically about Pope Ratzinger's comments at Regensburg, distinguishing violent aspects of Islam and sort of faith and reason about how...
Of religion generally. Not
religion generally,
yeah.
but that certain elements of Islam,
yeah,
that are violent or do not accept religious toleration, violent conversion, being not accepted as rational in themselves, and just more generally about what guidance do we have as Catholics approaching the Syrian refugee crisis as something that can presents issues that are not just a question of, that aren't present, for example, in Hispanic or Latin American immigration.
Yeah, so these are all great questions, that one too. You know, it's not accidental that Catholic social teaching in general, and you know, Pope Francis, you know, not in any way different from anybody else, has always emphasized that it's not about prescribing specific solutions and outcomes. That is the work of people who are involved, faithful people who are involved in politics and the common good and the society, who bring all of their expertise and knowledge to bear, who make prudential judgments in difficult circumstances that, you know, that aren't clear and that have to be revised and so forth, right? That has always been clearly stated in the Catholic social tradition that we have to do that. But at the same time, that in order to do that well, what the church is trying to do is to orient us the right way, right? Give us the right starting points, give us the right sort of places to stand to construct something strong, right? Or to use the analogy that, that Jesus himself used in the gospel, the solid ground on which to build so that the house doesn't get blown away right away. And so I think that's what it gives us in this debate. It's not saying, well, you should ignore the fact that there are genuine security concerns or unique circumstances here that weren't present in other refugee flows, right? It's realistic. But it's saying, instead, you know, but let's make sure that we're oriented in the totality of the way that we're facing this problem in a way that takes into account all of the fundamental principles. Protecting the common good and therefore limiting the threats to the common good that are posed by violent terrorism is definitely a part of it. But, you know, it's no less a part of it to say our obligation and solidarity to the oppressed, our responsibility for causing the flows to begin with, our responsibilities, our duties to embrace the stranger, and to, you know, and the universal destination of our material goods, are all also fundamental principles. Are we keeping them all in play? Are we keeping them all in balance? Are they all there? Or are we allowing one of them to dominate the others at the expense of the whole? If it's the latter, then it's a problem. Right? Does that answer you, or are you going to keep
it? I'm just curious the extent to which you think that there hasn't been any, or I'm not aware of any emphasis at all on the Muslim characteristic there that Ratzinger brought. He brought that into the discussion, and it doesn't seem to be part of the discussion anymore. And is that something that needs to be considered as part of the holistic assessment?
Yeah. So I
even if it's not prescribing a particular policy, it's still making it clear that that's an important consideration.
So to the extent that what's going on has been very is to the extent your question is much more specific about the distinctive kind of problem and threat that is present in a certain part of the Muslim world and how the church is facing that. I think it's probably true at the very margins that that Francis has been less explicit about it than Benedict, but really only at the margins. I mean, because in fact he's said quite a bit about it, especially when you look at the people, you know, who are with him. So whatever, Cardinal Turan, who heads the Council on Interreligious Dialogue, or Archbishop Tomasi, who was the nuncio before the UN in Geneva, would routinely and have routinely talked about these things. So it's not as absent as one might think from the current constellation. And it also wasn't as emphasized as one might think under Benedict. I mean, you know, a lot of the secular world took Benedict's Regensburg comments and blew them way out of proportion relative to the truth of what he was trying to express and how often he said it. He was also very, very careful about, you know, wanting to distinguish you know, the pathologies of certain parts of coming from the Islamic community from, you know, from the rest, and of trying to emphasize that, you know, the temptation to violence is a temptation that exists in every religious tradition, because it's part of the very nature and expression of our religious sense that, you know, that wants to close off things in such a way as to turn them into ideologies. And Benedict, you know, emphasized that pretty consistently, even in the Regensburg talk, let alone elsewhere. So yeah, at the margins it might be true, and one might justifiably critique some of the curia today for maybe not saying it enough, but I wouldn't overstate it. Yeah?
I'd like to ask a slightly more abstract question.
Okay. We haven't been abstract enough.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So, as I understand it, the end of society in the Catholic tradition is the common good.
The end of society is eternity.
Okay.
But no, I'm just quibbling. I'm quibbling.
Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, that's right. It's good to be precise here, because I guess I'm asking a specific sort of question. So, in the modern era, we tend to have this idea that, at least as a contractual matter, like the government, and some have tried to distinguish this from society as a whole. You know, like in the Declaration, it talks about the end of government being like securing these rights.
Right.
So I guess my question is, what is the relation between rights and the common good? And specifically, I'm thinking of some of the debates between, I guess, like the personalists, like someone like Maritain and others who, you know, you refer to the universal destination of goods. How should we understand the common good
as opposed to securing rights on a more limited sense.
So I guess you open the door for an abstract answer. So I'll give the abstract answer, but then you can flesh that out if you want to. In the most summary way that I would put it is, rights express aspects of the common good. The totality of the common good is more than that. And rights aren't something that's somehow separate from or against the common good, right? Which, you know, is the way, for example, some kinds of collectivist, utilitarian forms of theories would, right? You've got the common good, but then rights protect against that in some way or limit it. I think from a Catholic perspective, you have the total of the common good, which consists in the conditions that are conducive to the flourishing of all of the members of the community, right? Each and every one of them. And in order to give more content in detail to common good, because you can say that and say, okay, well, now what am I supposed to do, right? Great, the sum total of conditions that are conducive to the flourishing of all the members of our community. So that means what,
yeah.
Right? So one way to think about what the specifications of rights are is trying to flesh out the content of what that is. It's saying, okay, if we are going to be attentive to the well-being and flourishing of all the members of the community, there's certain things that we owe to one another, and there's certain things we may never do to one another, right? We have to protect people's lives. We have to protect people's liberty. We have to allow them to, you know, participate in their communities. We have to, protect family life. We have to allow them to worship freely. Those are all aspects of what it means to seek the common good. So there isn't a conflict between them. Now, there can be conflicts between different rights. But precisely if we see them all as unified as part of a single common good, then we have a framework in which to reconcile those rights. We can say, okay, but we have to understand that they're both trying to seek the same, you know, the same set of conditions as a whole. So how are we going to give, this comes back to the question of how are we going to deal with refugees then, right? In a way that doesn't reduce the problem to just one facet of it. As soon as we start taking one right, what might be a right to national security, or it might be a right to privacy or autonomy, and exalt that one over the other ones, then you're doing violence to the common good. Because it's only one part of it. There's only one little fragment of it. And then there are other parts of it that aren't expressed in the language of rights at all, that also have to be taken into. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, no, I think for the most part, yeah. Cool. Well, if we don't have any further questions, thank you all for coming.
Sure. It's fun to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful.
Thanks. Close out the presentation?
Sure. Okay. Yeah, just go ahead and eject that, and I'll take that.
This is what we're saying. There are so many conditions.
There you go.
Awesome. Thank you.
Here you go. The symposium next month, so it's kind of addressed, but.
Oh, okay. Unfortunately, I have to go to class right now,
or
else I would go to lunch with you, but thanks so much for coming. Really appreciate it.
It was great to spend some time with you.
Absolutely. That was
so
fun.
Good luck with finishing up.
Thanks very much.
And, stay in touch.
Thank you. I will.
You can
do my send you information on what's going on.
I'm
Notre Dame.
Okay. Yeah,
I'll soon. Love to stop by.
When's the wedding?
September 2nd.
I have my car here.
And if you're in D.C.,
Yeah, with some regularity.
Okay. I'd love to get together once I am fully settled there.
Great.
Safe travels back.
Take
care.
Yeah,
thanks. I got to run the class.
Yeah, for sure.
Don't forget this.
Thank you. Sweet, let's turn that off.
Do you want me to go ahead and just bring that to the lecture table?
I'm thinking that...